This episode of the Two Fat Expats is brought to you by the Shangri-La Doha. To book your next day, go to www.shangri-la.com/Doha.
Must save money in an expat world.
Money, money, money. Must spend money in an expat world.
Oh.
Did you know that as a little girl I was obsessed with ABBA?
Me too. And you're younger than me.
Like obsessed.
Oh, yes. I remember bouncing on the trampoline with Peggy Sue Frankham listening to Fernando, and she cried. She was so caught up in the emotion. We would have been 10, I reckon.
Love them. Still do.
Yeah, so do I. I don't think I love them as much as you. I think I might have overdosed, because I do distinctly remember them coming on in my car once accidentally, and you were very excited. Says we're going to be talking about money this week, but first,
yes.
tell me about your week. What have you been up to?
I'm a little bit of a sick chook this week. I've got some type of like throat infection. So I was at the doctor's this morning and I've taken my medicine and I feel a bit woozy.
Uh-oh.
So hopefully I don't come off any ditzier than what I normally do.
And do you have a husband at the moment, or is he away?
He's here. He's been here for, I think, 2 or 3 weeks now, and he heads off on Sunday for another couple of weeks. So I've had him here for a few weeks and then he's off again. But we're not complaining, because there's so many people there's just a mass exodus at the moment in Doha. It's really scary. It's a really weird feeling here at the moment.
I have heard this. I mean, I'm obviously not in Doha. I will be. I've got one more week to go and I will be back in Doha. I have now not seen my husband and my younger three for 5 weeks.
Oof.
I know. So six.
It's one hell of a reunion.
Oh, yes. I'm actually a little bit frightened about what my husband's expectations may be about that reunion.
I won't text or call you from about 8 p.m. onwards.
Yeah, so only 6 more trips to radiation and I'll be done. Which is...
It's been interesting, because I've had a few people ask me how you are, and I said that actually radiation has been a lot harder for you than what we all expected it to be. We kind of thought this was the easy one for you, didn't we? And then it's really taken its toll.
Yeah, it has. I think probably too. I put a lot of focus into chemo and getting through chemo, because I knew that was going to be the one that made me sort of sick. And I didn't really factor in what happens in radiation, because you don't get sick. You just get burnt and you get tired. A friend of mine who had liver cancer last year, he keeps sort of ringing me and saying, are you sure you're still okay to drive? Are you sure you don't need me to come and stay? Are you sure you don't need this or that? Because you do get very, very tired. But no, I've been really, really lucky that I'm just starting to get tired now, and we're at the end of it. Do you know, mm-hmm. I've managed to kind of work all the way through, which has been great. And but I had a little chat to my boss, who we're all going to hear from a little bit later in this episode.
I know, very exciting.
I had a little chat to him yesterday, and I'm going to take a week off sort of towards the end of this week, because it's, you know, getting to that stage and probably need just a little bit of a break. Now, Sayers, I know you saw, because I saw your comments on Instagram, you saw who I was with last night, didn't you?
I know, you were with your girlfriend last night.
I was, and I completely... Now, the weird thing for me with Annabelle Crabb is because we're both from Adelaide, and she's just a bit younger than me, but we have a lot of mutual friends. And so I think this is full credit to her, because You know, sometimes when you've actually met someone in real life, even as they've been a younger person, like pre-celebrity, and then they become this huge thing. And I mean, Annabelle Crabb, it became very apparent to me last night that she has become huge in Australia. Like she had a crowd of, and I mean, she was in front of a home crowd, but absolutely amazing response from the audience. There were 2,000 people there last night. She booked out the Adelaide Festival Theatre, and she was so clever and witty and just fantastic, like a really big belly laugh sort of show.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, you know, having met her in her university days, not that she would ever remember, like it was a house party and, you know, lots of people and whatever, but then knowing her and knowing lots of her friends and hearing her, I completely still became speechless and fangirled all over her. So I was really lucky I got to sit in a box because friends had tickets and, you know, everyone feels sorry for the cancer kid. But But afterwards I got her to sign something for me, and I had a couple of girlfriends with me, one who also knew her, but I also got a bit giggly. And we got a photo taken and had a bit of a chat, but she was beautiful. She said, I love your scarf, because of course I'm still bald and having to wear a headscarf, and I love your scarf, and had a bit of a giggle. And then I said to her, I have a podcast with my girlfriend Sarah in Qatar, and we talk about you all the time. And I was telling her just to tell her, you know, we've mentioned you and talk about you and we love you, because I was completely in, oh my God, I love you so much. I can't believe I'm standing here. Can I please touch you and just rub you? And
you didn't use those words, like, can I rub you? It was in your head.
And to my horror, she wrote down the name of our podcast, actually got a texter and wrote Two Fat Expats on a post-it note. And then, of course, I had immediate remorse, because it was like, oh, my God.
She's going to listen to us.
She's going to listen to us and, oh, God, she's just going to listen to us and realise how crap we are and how terrible. Do you know, like, you just immediately go into no. But, yes, it was just it was really good.
This may be a bit politically incorrect and we'll blame the medicine that I'm on if it is, but it's almost like you had an adult version of Make-A-Wish Foundation. That really bad to say that?
Not at all, because that exact thought crossed my mind.
Well, obviously we're either both really bad and politically incorrect, or it's absolutely okay to say it. But you've had a Wish Foundation spectacular last night.
I had that exact thought, because, I mean, I'm going to do a massive amount of name dropping in this next sentence. In the box I was in was, because it's the Adelaide Fringe Festival at the moment, and the box I was in was with the organiser of the Fringe, the leader of the opposition, and a number of, you know, other people that I'm sure must have been important, but I just didn't know, and me with my headscarf. And that did cross my mind right in the middle of it, that people would have been looking up in the box and going, okay, well, that's the leader of the opposition and that's the woman who's organising the Fringe, Heather Kroll, and, yes, I know that woman. She works for a very, you know, significant politician. And, who's that slightly plump woman with the headscarf? Oh, they must just be doing something nice.
Oh, too funny.
Anyway, Sarah, we're going to be talking about money on this one, because...
Yes, breaking every etiquette rule, because they say, etiquette says you're not supposed to talk about money.
No, you're not. And do you know, that's a big thing for me, because I have taken on a new role. I work now for a guy who in Australia is commonly known as the Barefoot Investor. And he has a syndicated news column that sort of goes out into the weekend papers here in Australia. And he also is on the radio a couple of times a week. And he has an up-and-coming podcast on its way out. But that has been a big thing for me, Sarah, is because he talks about money in everyday conversation all the time. And I have very much been trained that there are certain things you don't discuss with money. You know, you never ask people how much money they earn, and you never, you know, ask them how much they've saved. And of course, now in this job, you know, we filter through
all the time.
Like, we filter through thousands of questions, and they're all about, you know, if I don't know how much money someone earns or how much they're paying off their house or their car, the question becomes irrelevant. So I really have to know that information to know, you know, which kind of parcel they're going to go into for Scott to answer their question. And it has been a big thing. And of course, he talks to me about money in a very personal way, and I get all flustered and embarrassed and don't want to tell him, because it's a big fat secret, you know. When he says, how much super do you have, and it's like, I don't think it's appropriate that we have this conversation right now. He's like, I don't know if anyone's told you, Kirsty, but I'm a money guy. You might have heard of me. I'm on the radio a couple of times a week. So he says, tell me about you and your money experience and your expat thing. Did you do it for the money, or did you do it for the experience?
We did it for the money, but that money has then given us the opportunity to have a great experience and go on adventures. As I've said in a couple of episodes, I was pregnant when Matt took the job in Abu Dhabi. And we were actually very naive with our first posting. We went for the big salary, but we didn't realise that we didn't get any other benefits. We didn't get any other expat benefits that we later found out that other expats were getting. So we didn't get a furniture allowance. We didn't get beach club memberships. We didn't get school fees. We didn't even get flights home. We just got this one lump sum, and we thought it was this big salary. But then when we got to Abu Dhabi, and this actually makes me feel physically sick to say this, but we were paying $80,000 Australian a year for the crappiest two-bedroom apartment you have ever seen. And so once you take into account, you know, furnishing a house, paying rent, paying for our flights home, really that, I mean, we were only there for 18 months before the global financial crisis got the better of us. We didn't save a penny, I don't think. And we really learnt our lesson when we moved to Doha, and we're on a completely different playing field here. And I think, you know, it's worked out well for us. But that year and a half in Abu Dhabi was just, looking back on it, we had a great time. We were brunching, we were shopping, we were going on holidays, because we thought it wasn't going to end. And then we started to hear the rumblings of a recession, and the newspapers were saying, oh, it's not going to happen in the Middle East, the Middle East is fine. And then all of a sudden you saw cars being left at the airport, gathering, you know, in a cloud of, you know, covered in sand. People were leaving their flats and houses open. People were running off, you know, with huge debts that they owed to the banks there. And it really, I mean, it was horrible in the UAE, awful.
You've raised two really fantastic points, Sez, and one is that it's getting that expat package right, isn't it, in this first start, because you can think that you're about to earn a lot of money, but expat life is so different to everyday life in the things that you may have to pay for that you hadn't thought about. Yes, that you've always got to have that little bit of money there in case everything goes a bit pear-shaped.
And I think we've definitely learnt from our mistakes in Abu Dhabi, and now here we're in a position where we're on a proper expat package. We now work with a financial advisor. We've got money there to escape if we need to, that, you know, we'll pay for a container home. We've got money for flights home to get our animals out of here, which costs an arm and a leg, to get animals back to Australia with our quarantine dramas and all that kind of stuff. We've now set up accounts that, you know, will help Sadie when she wants to go to university and for our retirement. And that doesn't mean we don't live a great life. We still live this fab life, but we are much more, I think it just comes with age and experience. And we've got this child that we have to think about. You know, when we moved to Abu Dhabi, she was this tiny baby. I wasn't thinking about schooling and university and all of that type of thing. Do you know what I mean? Whereas now, you know, she's eight. In 10 years' time, she's going to be at university, and we need to start, you know, making plans for that. We're very much open. We know, I mean, we don't spend large amounts of money without telling either one. I know exactly what comes in and what goes out, and we work on the budget together. I think it's very important that we very much still live our lives. We don't want to move back home and regret not having done things. So while we do save a really good amount of money, we've got to, I mean, if it was all to end tomorrow, we would be fine. Do you know what I mean? We won't go home empty-handed. But at the same time, we still like to go out for nice dinners. We like to go shopping. We like to, you know, Matt's 40th is coming up. We're going all out for his 40th. And we would never want to leave here with any regret of not enjoying our life. But we definitely save a lot of money, and it's worked well for us over the last 6-7 years. We've definitely learned from our mistakes that we made in Abu Dhabi.
What we did financially is same things. We went through different scenarios of that. There were some countries that we lived in where we saved a lot of money, and there were some countries that we lived in where we actually went backwards. But one of the things we did do before we left is met with a financial planner, and we set up different accounts. And I have sort of good and bad with both of that. And I wouldn't, had I not started working at the Barefoot Investor, I wouldn't be giving the answer I'm about to give now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was great was we had trauma insurance. And what that meant was when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, we had a lump sum that was paid to us. And that was absolutely fantastic. Now, a lot of people would tell you not to get trauma insurance because it is really expensive. And I know that a lot of people did say you could probably put the same amount of money away, you know, each month because it is so expensive. But I don't think G and I ever would have done that. So yes. I'm really glad I did that. With our financial planner, who, you know, to give him full credit, we wouldn't have had the trauma insurance had we not had him and had that advice from him. But what I have become really aware of is the fees that we've paid while we've had these managed funds. And I had no idea what they were. I hadn't paid any attention. And I had just put money, you know, each month into these managed funds, thinking, well, this is great because we're investing in the share market, this is all great. But now when I look back on it, we probably paid way too much in fees. But both G and I were just happy that we were doing it, you know, not to...
So then what would you suggest then as another alternative? Because when we've tried to do it on our own, I just like the fact that the money comes in and it goes before we even see it. I think there is a lot of danger in handling... Right, we're going to put this money aside because there's times in the month that you'll be like, oh, you know what, let's only put half of our savings in and let's go and buy that new TV. Yes. I think a lot of people, when they try to do it on their own, can fall into that, oh, we've got, let's quickly dip into our savings.
Yeah.
Whereas working with a financial planner, we don't see that money and we can't get access to, I mean, we can get access to it, but it's not easy to get access to it.
Yeah, I think you can still do it. You can do your own managed funds and you can do your own shares and you can do that and have that money come out straight away without you having anything to do with it or being able to get it as well. You don't need a financial planner to do that for you. So, like I said, says, This is me now. Me in July last year would have got a completely different answer because I would have said, oh, yeah, we're diligently putting our money in. We've got this guy and this is what we do. But the thing is, it wasn't until a girlfriend of mine who works for a group of financial planners, I was saying to her, you know, that I'd had this huge revelation after working at the Barefoot Investor that I'd never really looked into fees. And she said, oh, yeah, I don't give my money to financial planners because the fees are so astronomical. Like, how do you think these guys make their money? And
Yeah.
And so I think, yes, I do not want to slam financial planners because I think, yes, I think young people need to go and see someone, even a financial counsellor or, you know, someone that they really trust. But I also think, like you said, Sez, you've got to be really aware of the sharks that are out there.
There are a lot out there. I think we probably met with 5 or 6 people until we felt comfortable with someone.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to do it. I wanted to do it on our own. But after meeting with this guy, we just felt really comfortable with him. And from that, you know, apart from these savings accounts that we have, we were able to set up life insurance and everything like that, which, you know, living where we do. And, I mean, the thing that scares me the most is, and I'm, you know, the driving over here is ridiculous, mm-hmm. and it's scary. And I would not be surprised if something happened to Matt one day driving to and from work. He drives a hefty distance to and from work every day, and that's always in the back of my mind, knowing that there's life insurance there that takes care of Sadie and I if something was to happen is really important to me, that I probably wouldn't think about if we were in other countries.
Yes, and I think one thing talking about life insurance is always check if you are paying into your own super fund. Quite often those funds have life insurance as a part of them. So yeah, always check.
I'm back home, that's with our super that we pay our own money into, because obviously we're not earning super over here, and then we've got one with the Guardian Wealth guys.
Yeah. Look, I am not a money expert and I'm not about to tell anyone what to do with their money, but I would just say that is one of the things I've learned is consolidate everything. Don't end up having a whole, you know, a super with someone and a insurance with someone else and a plan somewhere else, because you will just be paying separate fees everywhere. And do go out and have a look at how does your managed fund relate to another and what are the fees exactly. And don't feel embarrassed, because one of the things was we had become such great mates with our financial planner that G and I were both a little, not frightened, but we didn't want to offend him. Do you know, because he sent us Christmas cards. He came and visited us on different expat locations that we've been to. We're Facebook friends. Do you know, we have a relationship with him, which we thought was great because we had this relationship. But because of that, we'd kind of stopped really looking at, well, how much are we paying for certain things and do we need everything that we signed up for at the beginning? Yeah. You know, because we were that classic young couple with a baby on our lap when we signed up. In fact, G has had our financial planner longer than he's had me. Now, on that, I thought, because we were talking about different locations and money, because not all expats have the luxury of talking about what they'll do with their money, because a lot of expats have no money at all because they have done exactly what you said you'd done, Sarah, which was signed up for an expat posting without sort of really knowing all the added extras that were going to come in. So I thought we could have a chat to Sam, who has done both expat experiences, and get her to tell us a little bit about her experience and what she's learnt along the way.
Okay. We first went to Dubai just over 8 years ago, and that was a huge move. I was just found out I was pregnant with my second, but things were financially tight in England, and then this Dubai thing came up, and we went and had a look, and it wasn't the scary place that you immediately think it's going to be. And we were there for a week and we had a good look around at schools and everything. And it was the right move. It made sense. But while we were there, the whole big world economy crash happened about 6 months after we got there, actually, which was tough in a way because we just made this big move. But we were fortunate in that my husband was on a project in Abu Dhabi, which was tough because he was travelling to and from Dubai, but it meant he'd still got a job because the project was still going ahead in Abu Dhabi and we could stay where we were. We didn't have to suddenly pack up and go back again. So that all worked out. But once that project had finished, things hadn't still picked up in Dubai. And so he was asked to move over to Qatar, where the company was setting up. We were plodding along in Qatar for probably 4 years we did over there, and things were great financially. The business was doing well, bonuses were happening, pay rises weren't happening, but that was snuck in other ways. You wouldn't get it in your pay packet, but you'd probably get a bit more on your expat package, and it would happen that way. And everything was good, and the kids could get what they want when they wanted it. We could go out for meals quite happily. But obviously things are getting a bit tough over in Qatar now as well. And then this not just because the oil prices and things have crashed, but with schooling, things were getting difficult. So, and then I took a flight home to the UK with the kids on my own and phoned hubby to say, oh, we're back in Heathrow, I'll call you when I get to my mum's. And he said, you won't be able to call me, I'm on the next flight to London. I've got a big meeting, don't do anything, I think we're on the move again. And that's when Calgary popped up. I was surprised at myself that I didn't question it, but my immediate reaction was, yes, let's go. And I think that's because I knew the bubble of the Middle East, good life, was coming to an end. And because we were having lots of discussions about schooling and all that would suddenly come to an end if we moved. So we came to Calgary. However, that has been another challenge in itself. I didn't expect the hit that we took financially when we got here. It was a big shock for me.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, Sam. So when you were in the Middle East, I mean, you were able to completely pay off your mortgage on your house in the UK.
Yeah, and one of them.
Right, and you were still able to sort of save, you know, you said considerably for the children.
Yeah.
And you lived this life where you could go out to dinner and you really weren't having to give money too much of a thought. But when you got to Calgary, and I guess probably we should explain what the differences are, particularly, number one is you start paying tax.
And what's that all about?
And I think the tax rate from memory, you tell me, what is the tax rate now?
I think it's 30%, but I'm not entirely sure. So it's still less than what we would have been paying if we were still in England, but it's a hell of a lot more than we were paying in the Middle East.
What have you found particularly difficult? Have you noticed that you've really had to start thinking about how much you spend on the weekly shop and what you offer the kids for the weekends?
Uh-huh, definitely. And it took me quite a while to get into a bit of a rhythm, but we sort of fell into it by accident, actually, and it was partly your fault because the kids were arguing about what they were going to eat one night. So, and I just finished rereading one of your blogs about pulling out meals from a box.
Yes.
So I sat down with them and we wrote down every meal that they liked, and we decided Tuesday was going to be Try It Tuesday. And from that, I got 3 or 4 weeks worth of menus. And so I would take those menus to the supermarket with me every week and just buy what we need for the week, the meals that we'd picked out. And it was, I amazed myself, and I don't know why I've never done it before, but I seem to be saving more money that way, because I'm not going around thinking, oh, what should we have for dinner tonight? Oh, maybe we'll have this, or maybe we'll have that, and get a load of stuff and it sits in the fridge and then we don't eat it and then we throw it away. And we stick to those menus now rigidly. I think we're in about week 24 of doing these now, and the kids love it.
Do you find where you're doing your weekly shop is different? Like, what supermarket are you going to in Canada?
Well, to start with, I was using Safeways, but purely because we didn't have a car for the first couple of months, and Safeways was a 20-minute walk away, so I was walking and doing the grocery shop and walking back, and that was the nearest shop, so I was doing it in Safeways, and everyone kept saying to me, you're mad, you can't keep shopping in Safeways every week, and they're right, because it's very expensive. So now I do my weekly shop in a Canadian Superstore, now that I've got the car, and I can make quite a few savings in there. And then just top up with bits and pieces from Safeway if I just need to nip somewhere quickly. But I'm also becoming part of this voucher culture that's over here that used to amaze me when I heard about it. You know, people have got vouchers for this and vouchers for that and money off this and money off that. And now I'm like, give me all the coupons you got going, because, of course, it makes financial sense. And I've got store cards for nearly every supermarket or craft store or hardware store, you name it, I've got it. And you know, whenever we're out shopping, here's my points card, and probably with the supermarket ones, every fourth shop I can almost get for free because I can get it on my points.
Oh, Sam, it's so funny because you are basically reciting my Canadian lifestyle to me. do you now? Because I know for me, we had moved from Libya to Canada, so it wasn't like we'd come from a glitzy expat life, because there was nothing glitzy in our life in Libya. But I had very strong memories of Asia, and you know, Sunday brunches, and you know, going to balls, and you know, having fancy things and whatever, and more time and cash. But do you look back now at your time in the Middle East and think about, you know, some of the things you've got up to and think, gosh, how life has changed for you as a family?
Yes and no, because we weren't a family that always went out for Friday brunch or went to, you know, the Poppy Ball and the Burns Ball and all the Irish Ball and all the rest of that. But you know, there were, because of the company Steve was with, there were events at the embassy and surreal things like going and meeting Prince Charles and Camilla for afternoon tea, and my middle child got to meet him and wave a flag, and you just think, crikey, that was so surreal. And a whole world away from where we are now. But I don't regret leaving the Middle East at all, and I love that we've come here and we're experiencing something different. And now, instead of going to the embassy and swanning it with, you know, Prince Charlie, we're going up the ski slopes and having a wonderful time in the snow, and the kids are learning to ski and snowboard, and we're spending probably more time together as a family because we're doing things that we all love doing. Simple childhood pleasures that don't cost us anything. We can just go to the park and have a great time for a couple of hours and then come back again, rather than having to spend 30 riyals a child to go into a mucky play area for half an hour and then wonder what you're going to do for the next 2 hours to entertain them.
So Sam, do you think you've just been lucky that you've had sort of the best of both worlds, that you were able to save the cash while you were in one location but also appreciate the beauty of another?
I think so, absolutely, yeah. And my husband actually really pinpointed it when I was struggling to get my head around the financial situation in the beginning. He said, you can't look at it as if, because it feels like we've taken a pay cut because we're suddenly paying all this tax out, and tax out on his wages and tax out on the car and tax out on this, that and the other. And he says, you can't look at it like we've taken a pay cut. He says, you have to look at it that we've had 8 years of bonuses while we were in the Middle East.
What were your thoughts, Sis?
I felt that I had a similar situation with Sam. I know of a lot of people, and they still do it. They do that commute from Dubai to Abu Dhabi, and that was a big thing when the global financial crisis hit. Dubai pretty much bottomed out. It was Abu Dhabi that was keeping Dubai afloat. So there were a lot of people living in Dubai and travelling to Abu Dhabi every day. And it just seems like they were in a very similar situation to us. You're living this high life in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, and then literally the bottom fell out of the place. I cannot even begin to tell you what it was like. It was crazy. And I understand that dreaded phone call of don't do anything, because I think we're on the move. that happened to us. One minute I'm, you know, living this life of luxury, and the next minute there was that phone call, do not do anything, do not spend anything. The bottom has just fallen out of this place. And we were just one of those lucky ones that within a week, Matt had the job in Doha. We were really, really lucky. And I think Sam talked about that Middle East bubble, and that's a definite thing, that we live absolutely in a bubble here. And when you leave and you move to another country, you realise what a bubble you lived in. I've had that from a lot of friends that have since moved on to other expat locations, or they've relocated back home, and we live in a bubble here.
Yeah, and I think it's a couple of reasons. I think obviously people come and they do make more money than they're used to at home, and so they start to spend. And it's also what's available for you to spend your money on. Like, it's if you're someone that drinks alcohol, you're going to have to go to a, you know, five-star hotel to do that, because you can't have a glass of wine in a restaurant on the street. Or you can go to the rugby club if you're that way inclined. But not everybody is. Like, there seems to be no halfway. But also you are surrounded by wealth. You know, you see a lot of people living the high life. But I think the other thing is too, is that if you have suddenly given up, you know, your local park and your local cafe that you can walk down to and, you know, your lovely rolling hills and your lifestyle that you really enjoyed, it's almost like you feel you have to treat yourself because, you know, I'm earning this money, so I'm going to give myself a treat and go out and do this because I haven't got that life that I've got at home.
Yeah, and I loved what her husband said, that you can't, when they were talking about, obviously it's not a pay cut that they've taken when they've moved to Canada, it's just that they're now paying tax. And you've got to take that it was 8 years of bonuses. And I think that's a really good tip for people to remember, especially for anyone that's living in the Middle East, is make use of those, you know, I'm using air quotes here, bonuses. Do you know what I mean? So maybe the way that we look at it is it's almost like we don't pay tax here, but we use that extra money that we're not paying tax to then put away.
And maybe this is a good time to talk to Kate, who talked about exactly that, making the use of the money, because she talked about how they perhaps weren't so frugal at the beginning of their expat experience and what they realised. I think the term she used was the end game. But I'll have you have a listen, Sez, and okay. You can tell me what you think of Kate's comments.
So I left Sydney in 1998 and had a posting to Singapore with the corporate company. Obviously thought I was going to be 2 years, have a great time. I didn't even really think about the saving plan, to be honest. I actually looked at it as a huge adventure. And I was in my, mid to late 20s. No idea, didn't want a man, didn't want any of those things, just wanted to travel and have fun, as us Australians do. Landed in Singapore, had a great first year. Then towards the end of that year, I met my man. Fell in love, got married, had two babies, or had one baby here. And then we moved, in 4 years, we went Spain, Tokyo, New York, New Zealand, and then back to Singapore again.
Wow.
And during that time I had baby number two in New York.
Now tell me, what was your husband doing in Singapore when you met him? Like, you had a corporate role as an expat. What was he doing in Singapore?
He was doing running a PR company, a UK PR company that he'd set up in Singapore, and he was MD of that operation.
I guess what's interesting with you two then is, like you've said, you set off without really a financial plan in place. But do you think your partner had more of an idea of financially what he wanted to do, or were you both kind of in the same space?
Yeah, I think we both had always done quite well. You know, not floating our own boats, but we were both just kind of driven and motivated in our careers, and neither one of us were really looking for a relationship to get married. So we'd both done quite well in our careers that money, you know, we were both saving, but not really putting out and going, right, we want to save to buy a house and we want to do this separately even before we met. It was just have a great time in life. I'm young and I'm going to enjoy it, and as long as I've got a bit of money to fall back on, I'm good.
So the reason I loved your comment so much, Kate, is you said in your comment that you'd seen many friends sort of live the high life, and everyone kind of believed that they were loaded, and then they got home and they found out that they were actually financially worse off than what they were. But you asked the philosophical question of, are you worse off? You know, if you've had this amazing time with travel, food, booze, friends and the whole works, you know, living this amazing expat life that nothing can kind of compare to, how do you, you know, is that what we reconcile ourselves with? And do you think something has changed in those 16 years with you and your husband? Because you mentioned the end game, that you think expats get to a stage where they get to the end game and think, oh, shivers, we better get our act together.
Absolutely. I think we've always kind of, even with having the kids, even though we started out not having a real plan when we met, and then we were like, okay, we've got children, we need to be a little bit more sensible. And as you said, we've had this amazing life and could have saved a hell of a lot more than what we have, but we're okay. We're better off than what a lot of our friends are who haven't done the travel and amazing life things. We put all our friends who are at home, say you've got a rock star lifestyle. So to have done all those things, we can check the box and go, we're okay. You know, if we lost our jobs, we're okay until we get home and can find out what, you know, get ourselves on our feet, etc. Have we changed? Yes. We're both now in our mid-40s and our children have just gone to New Zealand to boarding school, which is taking a massive big chunk of cash not paid for by the company. So that's when we really sat down and went, okay, where do we want to be in 10 years' time? How do we want it to be? Because meeting in a neutral country, not meeting in our home countries, we've never really planned on where home would be. Home has been Singapore. So we now are looking at, and a lot of our friends, I think, in the same age bracket and probably in their early 50s are going, well, you know what, actually we need to pull our heads in a little bit. We can still have a good life. We probably don't need to travel as much as we have. We probably don't need to buy the Moe and, you know, the expensive champagnes constantly. We can just cut back and have a good, nice lifestyle, not eat out as much as we can. You know, just make all those changes that you know that you could pocket a few extra $1,000 a month without blinking. Do you want to do it? No, but do you think you have to do it? Because we all don't want to be working forever. And I think we've really hit that game. And also, I think something else we've realised that a lot of expats make the mistake of is that we leave our home countries very young. Then we may go back in retirement age, but realise actually we're not entitled to any pension because we haven't worked for those 10 years that you need to work or those 30 years that you need to work in that country. So actually you have no pension. But there's actually a book written that someone was telling us about, and it's classic. It's something called like classic mistakes expats make. And this would be the number one that we make when we're young and we leave and we don't actually truly think about our retirement. We think, oh, that's great, I've worked here, and you just assume because you're maybe still contributing to your super fund, but you don't actually think about your government pension.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, because we're talking about, you know, the whole end game and things you've started doing to make sure that you can sort of save a few more pennies, what other things have you done sort of, do you think, financially? Like, have you gone to see a financial planner, or have you looked at your investments and what to do there? Sort of, how have you changed in that way?
Yes, because we'd lived in so many countries, the first thing we did was go out to where all of our different pensions were, all the different schemes we'd been putting into, and see how we can consolidate all of those and what the ages are and what the criteria and are we losing money on them because they're taking out administration fees and those sorts of things. We've looked at the kids' schooling. My husband travels a lot, so we have a lot of points. So we're looking at, you know, we tend to have arranged our holidays around, you know, the points that we get from the different airlines, and, you know, we use our credit cards so we get extra points on everything instead of doing everything, you know, via cash and stuff. Financial planner, we haven't seen. We didn't have a good run with financial planners in our early days. We were wanting to do certain investments and they said no, and they were the ones who boomed. So for us personally, we've just really gone out to a lot of our friends, a lot of smart people that we respect who are older than us, younger than us, that we know are in the same situation, maybe better off, but thinking about the same things. And we all just talk about, what are you doing, where are you going, where are you planning your retirement, which is a big thing, because we want to live well for a long time. And we're looking at where majority of people are doing that in Asia, in the US, in Australia, wherever it shall be for you, to have a good quality of life for a long time. John and I both say there is nothing we would change about the life we had as expats. Wow, it's been amazing. And it has, you know, it's not planning on ending anytime soon for us. Sure, there's little things we could have changed and done better, but I don't really look at my life that way. I just think how amazing it's been and just keep moving forward on it.
Well, she's been to a lot of places. I really like Kate, and I love her attitude that she has to life. And I also love that she said that at first it was an adventure for her over money, and I think that's because she was single and young. And I think there's a big difference. I mean, I look at the time that I moved to London to work, that was for an adventure. It wasn't to save money. And when I look back on it, I earned a really, really good salary and I came home with not a cent in my bank account because I just lived it up. But I was young. I was in my early 20s and I just wanted to experience living in London for 2 years. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if we were to go and do that now as a married couple with a family, I would look at things completely differently.
Yeah, but didn't you love her philosophical question, though, of how important is it? Do you know, because if you are having a wonderful time and you are enjoying it all, you know, does it matter? And I guess that depends how long you're going to be an expat for, because, yeah, you can probably afford not to put any money away for a few years and live for the experience, you know, live for the,
yeah,
the experience, but then eventually, yeah, it is going to get a bit scary.
Yes, and I think it does come down to age and your maturity.
Yeah, and also your plans, because one of the interesting things that Kate talked about was being eligible for a pension. And I'd love to ask a question. I wonder if I don't know, Suz, if we can do one of those survey things on our Facebook page, because I'd love to ask the average expat, are they thinking that they will be you know, trying to get a pension? Because I imagine there's a lot of expats that think, well, no, we will be self-funded retirees. We won't need
and
a pension.
The pension is even going to exist. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm only 30. How old am I? I'm 37. Is the pension even going to exist when I'm 65?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I've looked into it, because that was a bit of a aha moment with Kate, is to get the pension in Australia, an expat needs to be back in the country for at least 10 years. So that means that you have to be back by the time you're 55 to then claim the pension.
And Cez, was that true, what she said? Did you go and do some research? Because I didn't, and I just wondered.
Yeah. I haven't. We, Matt and I, are saving for our retirement. We think about our retirement and where we want to be. But one thing I hadn't thought of, and neither had Matt, is the government pension, yeah, and that you have to be back in the country. Because 55 is still very young. Matt's turning 40 this year. That only means we've got 15 years left of being expats, and we had planned on being expats for a lot longer than that.
So, Cez, we had some really great comments. Who was one of your favourites?
So we had Robin, who comments on the page quite a bit, and she had some banking issues. She said it's too long a story, it needs to be told over cocktails. But that made them change things over the last few years. She said one thing being we now have multiple savings accounts in our home country. This has been great because a portion of my husband's check goes directly to each of these accounts and we save money without even missing it. And I know, yeah, it's that when that ping of joy comes in every month, Robin, our money goes straight out. We don't even see it because I know I would spend it. So I'm with Robin on that one.
Do we have to explain the ping of joy again? Because there's the ping of pain and the ping of joy, yes, isn't there?
There's a ping of joy that only happens once a month, and that is when the salary comes into the account and Matt gets a text message from the bank saying all the money is there. Then slowly but surely over that month there is the ping of despair, and that as the money goes out and he gets those text messages. And that is why we have our money that as soon as it comes in, a big chunk of it gets taken away straight away and we don't even see it.
Okay, so I think this might be a good place for us to talk to the Barefoot Investor. And, you know, just in case anyone missed it at the beginning, in full disclosure, I work for the Barefoot Investor. And I had this really weird moment, Cez, where you and I, you know, plan what we're going to talk about bizarrely, actually months in advance. We did plan, yes, what we were going to talk about. And we, so at the beginning of the year, we came up with a whole lot of ideas of what we thought would be great. And one of them was expat money. And of course, I began working for the Barefoot Investor. And so then I sort of said to you, is it weird if I talk to him? Because, you know, are people going to think that I'm kind of promoting him because I work for him? Or is it weirder not to talk to him because I work for someone that is in the media all the time and interviewed on the radio all the time with financial advice? Was it weird not to talk to him when people, yes, sort of knew? So I asked him, which was even stranger, having to go to your boss and saying, would it be weird for me to interview you? And he said, no, you just do whatever you feel comfortable with. So I had a chat to him and says I really enjoyed it because one of the analogies that I think is brilliant is Scott has been working for a long time with a lot of professional sports people, in particular people who play Australian rules football and NRL, National Rugby League.
Yeah.
Yes. And I've always thought that expats and professional sports people have a lot in common in that they sign up for a contract that may only be for a few years, or it's for a very specific amount of time, and in that time they're going to earn more money than they probably would have in other circumstances, and that they have to be really clever about that money in that time, because it is going to run out. You know, the expat gig isn't going to last for everyone forever. You know, we've seen it, you know, sort of we've seen just in recent times how quickly, if things turn a little pear-shaped, you know, expats are the first to go. And also because those expats' jobs tend to happen in countries where that staff is limited, but over time staff are getting retrained, and you know, even in Qatar where we have something called Qatarization, where you know, jobs go because they need, the government has an initiative to put Qataris in those jobs that expats now have. So I thought it was really, it would be really interesting to talk to Scott about what his thoughts were financially about expats.
So the advice that I give most of the professional sports people that I work with, and generally it's AFL and NRL players, you've got to understand that these guys aren't emotionally ready in many respects to deal with large amounts of money. So we're talking about $200,000-$400,000 a year that they may be making, and they have come off earning basically nothing in many instances. So even though they're starting to get paid a large amount of money, emotionally they haven't been conditioned for that. And the problem is that they become an AFL footballer. Everybody expects them to be spending up, to be having nice cars, to be buying things, and to be, you know, to be the big man. And in many instances, what I've seen over the years working with, you know, the different players, is that a lot of them can get through their careers, their playing careers, and have nothing really to show for it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there are similarities with that with expats who actually think that they're going to earn a large amount of money. They may have a goal, but then when they get conditioned around other people who are earning large amounts of money, what tends to happen is that your spending goes up to the level of everyone else around you. And there is an expectation that because you have more money, you spend more money. And that can be a real problem. So the advice that I give to specific players is to try and make their financials as automatic as possible. Eddie Maguire said to me many years ago that his goal for Collingwood players, whether you play one game or whether you play 400 games, is to own your own home after you've finished your football playing career. And I think that's really great advice for Ed, from Ed, and it's something that I encourage the players that I've been looking after to do, and that is to try and make things as automatic as possible, and to not actually see that money hit your account, so that you are living way below your means, and you know, that's the way to do it, so that you don't have to think about it too much. You don't have to struggle with yourself, because the spender will always win.
And what would you say to a couple who's heading off on expat life together? Because so often with couples, both of them have very different ideas. One person might be thinking about the opportunity for travel and the excitement of heading away, while the other person's really thinking of buckling down and saving. What advice do you give to couples to make sure they're on the same track?
I think that you have to work on it as a team and have a shared goal. Because if one person is doing it because they want to save a large amount of money and the other person is going along belatedly because they can spend a lot of money, that's not going to work. And that doesn't matter whether you're an expat or whether you're both working, you know, in Melbourne. You have to be on the same page. So the way that my wife and I do it is we share the same bank account. And anything over $400 that we spend, each of us are going to spend, we talk about it beforehand. So that allows us to have communication on what we're doing. But as far as a couple going off to earn money as an expat, I've seen that happen years ago when the mines in Western Australia were paying large dollars. And my experience with that of dealing with lots of people who went and did that is that very few of them actually achieved their goal to actually save large amounts of money. In many instances, what happened is that it was kind of crappy living, you know, in a mining camp, and they would have a couple of weeks off and they would end up spending large amounts of money. Or alternatively, and this is the other thing that happens with a lot of AFL footballers, when you're investing, when you're making a lot of money, people come out of the freaking woodwork to tell you, look at how much tax you're paying. Have I got a deal for you? Let me show you how to invest that money. And I know that's the case with expats that I've helped in the past as well. They look at all this money that they're earning and they think, I've got to do something with it. And many instances, that's where you jump out of the frying pan into the fire. So before you go towards actually embarking on this, where you can actually make significant amounts of money, you need to have the plan beforehand. And it's got to be stress tested. You've both got to be on the same page and you've both got to have a plan as to how you're going to do it. And it's got to be sort of win-win, you know. So if you've got a partner that doesn't really want to be over there or is doing it because you can set yourself up financially, you do actually have to have something within your plan where they can win as well. It's a negotiation, because it's not going to win if, you know, you're the person going over there saying, I'm not going to spend any money. I'm going to, you know, come back and pay off a house and live in, you know, beach house in Adelaide or something, which is not going to work. For instance, if you are listening to this and you're an expat, and I understand that this is the podcast for expats, and you've gone over with all the best of intentions and ended up spending more than you thought, and basically, you know, been stuck in a bit of a muddle and thought, hang on, gee, I really should be saving a lot more, what I can tell you is that you are freaking normal. You are so normal, it's not funny. Because I've dealt with people that have scored huge jobs, huge paying jobs years ago on the mines and have done the same thing. I deal with AFL footballers who have done the same thing. And there's a couple of reasons for it. The first one is when you start earning large amounts of money, you get used to it, right? Aruna Bay is one of a brilliant author and a very close friend of mine. He's got a book called How Much Is Enough. And he's got this term that he says, it's called hedonic adaption. So you adapt to the amount of money that you earn. And then the second thing is that you are in a foreign environment with a large group of people who are all earning the same amount of dough and all have the same sort of spending habits that you do. So you get carried along with those people who are probably doing the same thing that you are, which is not saving a lot of money. Now, there are parallels to that of AFL and NRL footballers. You're all earning large amounts of money compared to your mates that you went to school with. And because you're earning large amounts of money, you all end up, you know, spending most of it on stuff that you shouldn't, cars and clothes and all that sort of stuff. So don't beat yourself up. But the only way that you can actually sort of tip that into your favour is what you don't see, you don't spend. Have a plan for your money that both your wife or partner agree with, and have it set up before you go over there so that you're left with money, blow that, but make sure that you get paid, because that's the reason we're over there.
I was really impressed. Before I listened, I thought he was going to be very like a schoolmaster. Like, this is what you have to do and you're doing this wrong and you've got to do this and you've got to do it my way. That's kind of what I thought it was going to be like, but I was very pleasantly surprised by him. And what it is so right, that analogy with sports, you know, with football players and expats, especially for young expats, because you're not emotionally ready. Matt and I have always talked about, imagine what it would have been like had we met a few years earlier, had we gone to Dubai when we were young and we were both working in fantastic jobs, we would have earned so much money. And I've always said to Matt, yeah, but you wouldn't want Sarah in her early 20s in Dubai earning all that money. We wouldn't have saved a penny. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's something that young expats that move over here and they're making all this cash, they're not, they may not be thinking about their future. They may not have children yet. They may not be thinking about, I've got to pay for university, I've got to get my kids set up, I've got to pay a mortgage, I've got to own my house outright. Young expats may not be thinking like that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is often said at the Barefoot Investor too is, you know, it's not about dunking your tea bag seven times or cutting your lunch every day for work. I mean, sure, they're all great tips for saving money, but you have to be able to live life and have fun. But just be clever, like be aware. And, you know, I think it's really interesting that so many of the people that wrote to us says in the community talked about how, and you yourself talked about, I have to have that money just taken away from me and not see it. And that's exactly what he told people to do, like get it all sorted out, have it go off into your different, I mean, at the Barefoot Investor they talk about it going off into your different buckets. Someone else mentioned a guy called Dave Ramsey in the comments, and I know he has little envelopes. A lot of times it's about taking control too. I think a lot of the time for me with money, I just walked around with my head in the sand because it all seemed too hard. And, you know, having a budget is really not fun, and having money conversations is not fun. And, you know, quite often they're the ones where you're having an argument with your partner. And having read through, you know, all these thousands of questions from people, it's always money and relationships that's the big thing.
And, you know, I'm being 100% honest here. Matt and I have never fought over money, not once.
That's so impressive. Oh, my God, that's so impressive.
And I am telling you, hand to heart, we have never had an argument over money. But I have definitely matured since I've met Matt. And we're actually, Matt and I were laughing about this the other day when I came to him of some ideas that I'm having and things about saving. He's like, what have you done? Where's my wife? This was not you. And I think it just comes with age and maturity, and your perspectives change and your goals change. Scott said, you know, that as couples, you know, you've got to share the same goal and be on the same page. And I think maybe that's why we don't fight over money, because we do have the same goals. Matt and I are very open and honest. He doesn't hide things from me. I don't even spend 200 or 300 reals without telling him first, and likewise. And we have the same goals and we have the same plans, and I think that's why it works.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things we talk about at work is the serviette strategy, which is if anyone's isn't on the same path with their partner, is, you know, maybe to sit down, and it's something that was mapped out over a serviette over dinner, of having your three buckets of where your money goes and really sitting down and talking about, you know, getting on the same page. Because it's easy to say, oh, well, we've both got the same ideals. You know, Sez, you and Matt have actually gone and sat with a financial planner and talked about what's going to happen with your money. A lot of people just say, oh, no, we both want the same thing. But while they're both saying they want the same thing, one person's out, you know, constantly at the cash machine, you know, spending, and the other one's sitting at home having a hernia. And I know one of the phrases that Scott uses that I absolutely love is, a guy wrote in one week saying, you know, I've fallen in love with this woman and I really want to marry her, but I'm a little bit worried because she's really crap with money, and, you know, I'm quite good with money. What do I do? And the phrase that Scott used is, well, in this relationship, one of you is going to get fat and one of you is going to get thin. You know, she's either going to, you know, bring you to your side, or you're going to take her to yours, either way. And it's so true. And I had a real moment of, I think I might have made Greg a little bit fat, because because he has always been in control of, you know, we should be doing this and this is, and it was giving him an ulcer while I was saying, yeah, but still going off on my own little tangent. And I think it's so unfair to do that to someone in a relationship. You can't just keep, you know, talking the talk without walking the walk.
Yeah. See, I think probably over the last 12 years of being with Matt, I've gotten thinner, and I wish it was actually fat off my body. I've actually quickly gotten fatter, but financially I've gotten thinner. I've gone to his side of things. Well, thank God for that, because I tell you what, as my mum used to say, I would be the most fashionable homeless person there is. I'd be surrounded by my Louis Vuittons and Chanel living on the streets if I hadn't married Matt.
Absolutely. So, Sez, tell me, what's your social media pick this week?
Well, we tend to talk a lot about TV in this podcast, which makes me think that you and I sit around watching a lot of TV when we actually don't. But the last few episodes, we've talked a lot about some shows that we've found. I have found one this week that actually went to air in the UK late last year, but it's actually come onto the BBC channel here in the Middle East, and it's also available on iTunes. It's called Dr. Foster, and it's a drama set in a small English village about a local GP, Gemma Foster, who discovers her husband has been having an affair. But not only that, her friends and colleagues all know that he's been having an affair and has kept it secret from her. It's really good. I mean, from the first episode, I was hooked. And it's basically, does this doctor carry on as normal and try and save her marriage, or does she go absolutely hell for leather, destroying everything in her path? Like, imagine your best friend knowing your husband has been having an affair and has helped him do it and not told you. So she's got the shock of finding out that her husband has had an affair, but also her best friends have been in on it.
And in Australia right now, there's only one thing on the telly that you have to talk about, and that, of course, is Molly.
Yeah, Molly Meldrum.
Yes.
Both episodes, we haven't watched them yet, but I've bought them onto iTunes.
So, yes, there's Molly was the compere of an Australian television show called Countdown, and he was just an Australian icon, and they've brought out a two-part miniseries. I've only watched one. I haven't had the spare night because, of course, I was hanging out with Annabelle. But I'm looking forward to watching the second one. But you're right, we haven't had the same sort of social media pics, and I think for me it's because I just – have been absolutely chock-a-block with kids and, well, the kid and work, because I've been doing trying to sort of fit work in around making my way to radiation, which is like a two-hour round trip in the mornings and takes way too much time for what's involved. And I just haven't had, for me, if there's anything I'm going to have a break, it's going to be I'm just going to lay on the couch and watch telly. So, says, I think we got some great responses on the money, but, you know, not as many as we have in other subjects. Do you think that that just is because it still is a little bit icky to talk about money?
Absolutely. And I think it's also a pride thing that if you've had financial strife and troubles, it's sometimes very hard to be honest about that. You know, even for me, I was like, oh, do I talk about Abu Dhabi? And we left with hardly a cent in our pocket. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, because that, if it wasn't for that happening to us in Abu Dhabi, I don't think we'd be as a good in financial situation as we are now, because we learnt from that big mistake. So I'm glad that it happened.
Yeah, it says, and you've raised a point. I remember going to a woman came back to Qatar who hadn't been around for a long time, so she organised a bit of a lunch and a get-together. And I was talking about how I'd started at the Barefoot Investor, and then somebody else started talking about, you know, money and what they did. And there was a woman there who's a really good friend of mine who's a lawyer, but she started to talk about exactly what they did with their money, because she's a very clever woman and she's really switched on about investments and, you know, who's the best person to get a loan through and where's the best savings account and whatever. And it was just so refreshing. She wasn't bragging. She wasn't talking about how much money they had. She was just giving sound financial advice. And I think too often we're not having those conversations. It would make sense for a group of expat women to sit around and say, hey, I've found that this bank gives the best interest rates to expats, and I've found that I got my loan, because that's another thing. When we've just recently, you know, taken the loan for a piece of land, and we couldn't use a certain bank because we were outside of their jurisdiction, and because we were expats, there was a whole different conversation. So we need to talk about money more, and we need to, and not how much we've got, but just what the best ways of working with it are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, says, well, we've only got one more of these episodes to do with the crappy sound where we're not next to each other and we have to tee up.
No more talk at the top of each other. Well, it'll be minimal.
And we'll actually get to sing together and won't inflict our single voices onto you.
Now, this is a bit of a brag. You're going to be back in time to go to the Shangri-La's grand opening party.
Now, tell me about that. What happens at the Shangri-La's grand opening party?
All I know that it is going to be a bit whiz-bang, and we have to get our glad rags on. Yes. That's all really I know, but I'm so, very selfishly, I'm so glad you're going to be back, because I didn't want to go on my own, because I hate walking into a room where I don't know anyone and all the eyes turn to me. So I'm so glad that you're going to be there next to me. But I think it's going to be a really fun night, and they're having the president of the whole of the hotel chain coming to it.
Oh, what do you do? Well, I will be very happily by your side and back in Doha by then, Cez. It'll be great. Okay, everyone, we'll see you or talk to you next week. Seems to be